This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we discuss a study recently released by the state that leaves us with more questions than answers.
Plus, a conversation with Navajo fashion designer Orlando Dugay.
That was what really pushed me toward evening wear, because I felt that that was a connection right there with mainstream society and what my family, our tribe, does.
That's coming up.
It's Thursday, November 7th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. In mid-October, the state released a report that studied the health impacts of living near drilling operations. And there is a lot to digest from that report. Here to break down what we need to know about the study and what it means for future policies in the oil and gas industry, we have three KUNC reporters, Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Hey.
Matt Bloom.
Hey, Aaron.
And Scott Franz.
Hey.
Thanks to all of you for joining us. Let's start with a brief recap of what the report found. The study was commissioned by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, who wanted to really look into the health risks of living near oil and gas wells. Ray, what did they find?
The big question is 500 feet a big enough distance between oil and gas operations and people's homes? And unfortunately, the study doesn't really come to any clear-cut conclusions, despite some of the headlines you might have seen that made it seem like they did.
Right.
The findings are a little confusing. They're all about potential hazards, potential being a key word. So, for example, they looked at cancer, and benzene is the main chemical behind that risk. Mm-hmm. It's one of many chemicals that are emitted from oil and gas sites. The researchers estimate that if 1 million people spent 30 years living near an operational oil and gas site, at most, about 20 of them might develop cancer from benzene exposure. And then for people living exactly 500 feet away from an oil and gas site, and also living downwind from it, so all that stuff is blowing towards them, less than 10 people in a million might get cancer from benzene. So you can see how, you know, there's a lot of like might and ifs in these statements, and it's a little hard to wrap your head around and come out with a clear answer.
So one important thing to note is how the research was conducted. What do you know about that?
It's really hard to study things like this. You know, in an ideal world, you'd be able to track people in detail for their whole lives and know exactly what they're breathing and what's going on at the oil and gas facilities nearby. But like closely monitoring people over years and years is very hard and expensive to do, not to mention like pretty big brothery. Instead, what they did is they started with some real air samples taken at oil and gas operations in Garfield County and then at a number of sites along the Front Range. And they plugged that information into a number of models that combined said, okay, if we've got these real world samples of air, you know, if we give all these scenarios of weather and wind patterns, and then also of like people and their various activities, like going to work versus staying at home, what are all the possible exposures that people could get of this whole range of chemicals? And by doing that, they came out with this whole heap of those potential hazards that we were talking about.
This study built on an earlier study that really didn't find major long-lasting health impacts, right? But it did call for further research.
There have been a lot of studies on this issue, you know, across the country. Here in Colorado, there's a researcher named Lisa McKenzie with the Colorado School of Public Health, and she has done a lot of work in this area. She says that the researchers in this most recent study, that they came to very similar conclusions that she did, but using a different method.
Which gives us more confidence in the results that there might be health risks from the air pollutants that are emitted from these sites. However, this, like all risk assessments, these are predictions about what might happen. They don't mean that anything will happen.
So she's saying this is evidence that we should be concerned and look into things in more detail. But other people have looked at the same results and concluded the exact opposite.
And the president of the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, Dan Haley, talked about the industry's take on the study at a state hearing last week.
This confirms there are no anticipated long-term health impacts, including cancer, for people living near oil and gas production. That's an important takeaway from this study, and it should provide further peace of mind to Coloradans.
Matt, what do you make of that?
It's interesting because initially, right when the study came out, they had this press conference where they're trying to play down its findings. But now they're kind of embracing it and saying, oh, this shows that, you know, our industry can't possibly have any negative long-term health effects on people. But the reality is none of these studies, including this one actually conclude that
right,
at the end of
the day? There are all these potential risks.
Mm. Right. So it's a pattern that we've seen over the years from the industry. So it's not necessarily anything brand new from them.
And that peace of mind that Dan Haley's talking about, what does he mean?
He means that over the last few years, the industry's gotten much better at making sure that their emissions of some of these chemicals that could cause cancer and other health effects are increasingly lowered. But the issue is it's hard to actually keep track of that. There aren't as many state inspectors as there are wells across all of Colorado. Right. So a lot of what we know comes from the industry itself in regards to their best practices.
And they are still building in areas that are close to where people live and go to school.
We have data that shows that more than 250,000 people in Colorado are living within a half mile of an active well. And that's less than 5% of the total population, but that's still a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, that's like what, Boulder plus Longmont plus more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the size of
it's
a couple cities.
Number of people, even if it's just 5% of
right.
the total.
Which brings us back to this really important question, I think, is what do we do to balance the growing concerns around our health and the fact that this industry is here and it's likely not going anywhere anytime soon.
And this presents a conundrum for lawmakers who, you know, that is part of their job here. And so, Scott, I want to turn to you about the political response to this report. I remember the presentation was not even finished that afternoon when some lawmakers began posting or emailing their take on it. What are the political implications of this report?
Yeah, lawmakers were very quick to send out statements and press releases, kind of trying to use this report for political purposes. But I don't think we're going to see a repeat of the really big drama we saw earlier this year when Democrats and Republicans fought really hard against each other over Senate Bill 181. If you'll remember, it's that big bill that gives local governments more power to regulate the industry. But it does look like this study will have some implications for the upcoming session. Democrats are telling me this report could help them pass some new proposals they're already working on for next year, including a more comprehensive health study that goes beyond this modeling. Now, Ray's raised some questions about, you know, how easy that might be when we're talking about things like blood testing and kind of a more rigorous review. But Senate Majority Leader Steve Finberg, a Democrat from Boulder, told me this week he wants to see things like that and a bigger study happen, you know, because it will really inform policymakers who are going to decide whether to impose more regulations.
I think it just adds to the mountain of evidence that this is industrial activity that can hurt people, and not only people, but our overall air quality and climate issues.
Meanwhile, Republican lawmakers are trying to poke holes in the study. You remember Matt talking about the industry saying that, you know, a lot has changed since the data was collected and these results came out. That's the exact point that Senator Ray Scott of Grand Junction is trying to make. He tells me he recently toured an oil rig in Broomfield that puts out zero harmful emissions. I asked him about the political implications, and he's predicting that Democrats are going to hurt themselves if they pursue more regulations because voters have spoken out against setbacks and other regulations.
Coloradoans spoke very loudly that they did not want any kind of bans on fracking. They didn't want any setback changes. Basically, they did not want to attack an industry that brings $31 billion and 200,000 jobs to Colorado.
The state regulatory agency, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, is going through changes as it adapts to those new rules from Senate Bill 181. How is this health study going to impact that process?
The COGCC says because of the report, it will immediately put more scrutiny on all applications that are within 2,000 feet of homes. This is the most immediate impact we're seeing from this study, and this more rigorous review process previously only applied to permits within 1,500 feet of homes. But Finberg doesn't think the COGCC is going far enough with that step. He's actually calling for all applications within 2,000 feet to be put on hold until this rulemaking process from Senate Bill 181 takes place. He's even suggesting that he might sponsor some new legislation next year if the COGCC doesn't take a more cautious approach in evaluating these permits.
Well, I want to finish with just some of your takeaways on this issue moving forward. I mean, it's clear that oil and gas production does have some health and safety risks, but at the same time, this industry is very deeply entwined with the state's economy and workforce. So is there common ground, a way for all sides to come together?
I don't know if I can answer that question, but one thing that really did strike me when I was talking to researchers is that we all assume that setbacks are the answer, that there's some one-size-fits-all distance at which everyone will be safe. But there are other ideas, too, like better monitoring these sites so that if they start to spew a large amount of chemicals, someone can go out and fix the problem.
And I also want to call attention to just the people who live near these wells. They have a lot of questions. I've talked to a lot of residents in Erie and Longmont who have these very real concerns about their health, and they still aren't getting their questions answered. So I think that's still going to be a lot of tension in some of these communities where you do have oil and gas really close to a lot of people's homes.
One thing I like to do when I cover these big heated debates over complex issues like oil and gas, you know, I'll dig through some of the newspaper archives. And, you know, this case was interesting because if you go back to the late 1920s, Colorado adopted its first regulations on oil and gas, and they weren't anything to do with health and safety. They were worried about oil and gas companies wasting some of the oil they were collecting. And so we've obviously come a very long way when regulation was all about protecting the resource. And now we have these very important questions about, you know, how do we find a compromise between an industry that brings so much money and jobs to the state while also balancing the needs of residents who live near them. And I don't think this debate is going to end anytime soon. It's already been going on for many decades. But, you know, what I am hearing kind of a common theme emerge at the Capitol is, you know, both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are calling for further study. Now, they kind of disagree on what that study looks like. Republicans will say, let's study the workers at oil wells and see the health impacts, whereas Democrats want more of a look at people who live near them. Yeah, and they'll probably also disagree on what the results will show.
That was KUNC's Scott Franz, Matt Bloom, and Ray Ellen Bichelle. Thank you all for looking into this so extensively.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
Now, Ray and Matt wrote up a detailed look at the study, the methodology used, and the implications. You can read that at our website, kunc.org.
Election day was on Tuesday, and while the dust has settled on most races, one of Colorado's largest cities is still without a mayor. Election officials are continuing to tally ballots in Aurora's mayoral race. Republican Mike Kaufman's lead has narrowed significantly since election night. The Denver Post reports Kaufman has a margin of about 1,100 votes over Democrat Omar Montgomery, who is a former head of Aurora's NAACP. Aurora is Colorado's third largest city and has been dubbed one of the most diverse in the United States.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
Studying to become a teacher comes with several requirements. One is a semester of full-time teaching. But these college students don't get paid to teach, and this financial burden keeps some from achieving their dream. As KUNC's Stephanie Daniel reports, a new program is removing that barrier.
Destiny Martinez is sitting at a small table in the hallway of Murphy Creek School in Aurora. She's working on reading exercises with three second graders.
So we're going to go through the first one and then the second one. So, okay.
Special one. America.
Martinez is a student teacher. She's 23 and Hispanic and says growing up in Denver, she didn't have teachers that looked like her.
And a majority of the kids in that neighborhood were Hispanic. But like I said, there weren't really any teachers that really knew anything about us. So it was kind of hard to connect to them.
That's why the senior at Metropolitan State University of Denver is studying early childhood education, or ECE. But unlike her classmates, she's getting paid to student teach through the new Prepare to Teach initiative.
The big cost of student teaching is the fact that you're paying for your student teaching time and working full time without getting paid.
Dorothy Shapland is an assistant professor of ECE at MSU Denver and a coordinator for the program. The full school year classroom residency program allows selected students, like Martinez, to teach 3 or 4 days a week while finishing their degree.
Many of our students of color, many of our students who have experienced some kind of hardship or come from generational poverty or have any kind of issues financially or struggling financially, have a very hard time completing student teaching.
And if they don't student teach, they can't get their license. Without it, graduates of ECE programs often end up working in preschools where they make a lot less money.
And so that's what we're trying to work on, is how to solve that.
Karen DeMoss works at Bank Street College in New York City and is the executive director of Prepared to Teach. The national project has worked for 4 years across the nation and is now working with dozens of partnerships between higher education and P-12 school districts around the country, including MSU Denver and other Colorado colleges.
But the problem is, if you don't have that grant funding or you don't have a big philanthropy behind you, how can a candidate afford to do an entire year of free student teaching?
Using data from these institutions, DeMoss is figuring out how to make residencies more affordable and accessible, as well as studying the financial burdens student teachers face.
We know you need to be able to focus if you want to learn. And we need to be able to help future teachers focus while they're learning so they can help our children focus when they're in school.
MSU Denver received $14,000 to plan and implement their residency program and paid two student teachers, Destiny Martinez, who we met earlier, and 23-year-old Aaliyah Humphrey.
Fantastic. How many syllables is that?
Three.
Humphrey, who is biracial but identifies as Black, is also teaching at Murphy Creek School. Growing up, she never had a Black teacher, so Humphrey is excited about the residency, but thinks her first real job will still be chaotic.
I think my first year, I'm probably still going to feel like that, but a little less hectic because I have been doing this now. I've been doing it for a year, and so it'll feel, I think, more smooth.
There's not a lot of data on the success of residency programs, but a report from the National Nonpartisan Research Group Learning Policy Institute says they can lead to less teacher turnover and better classroom outcomes. And it says students of color are more likely to enroll than other programs. Colorado lawmakers believe in them, too. They passed a bill last year allocating more money to expand effective teacher residency programs.
Go ahead and read.
The boys watch as
Destiny Martinez has been student teaching for less than a semester and already feels like she's making a difference.
Being one of the only Hispanic teachers here, I've already made connections with some of the girls that are Hispanic.
MSU Denver's teacher residency program is only funded until the end of the school year. But coordinator Dorothy Shapland hopes, through state or philanthropic grants, they can keep it going. Stephanie Daniel, KUNC.
While fashion designer Orlando Dugay's formal wear designs can be seen on the runways, he got his start watching his Navajo grandmother. Dugay's work is showcased in a new solo exhibit at Colorado State University's Avenir Museum of Design and Merchandising. KUNC arts reporter Stacy Nick spoke to Dugay to learn more about what inspires his work.
Your work is often noted for its mix of traditional Native American style and contemporary high fashion. How did that kind of evolve for you?
A lot of my inspiration comes from my upbringing. So I grew up on the western side of the Navajo Nation in a place called Gray Mountain, Shadow Mountain area. It's about 40 miles north of Flagstaff, Arizona. I grew up in Flagstaff. I went to school in Flagstaff from like first grade to eighth grade. But all through my life, we constantly were back home with my grandparents, my paternal and my maternal grandparents. And so I spent a lot of time with them on the weekends and the summer times. And so I learned a lot about ceremonial things and stories and songs. And so I was exposed to a lot of the traditional culture. And my family's pretty traditional, so it was not like I went on a culture camp or anything. So I infuse a lot of those stories and different aspects of the teachings in my work. A lot of it really pertains to the stars, and our relationship with the land. So I like to use a lot of florals and fauna in my designs.
Are there certain things that you kind of look to for inspiration?
I think mostly it's just like how when you look at the sky, everything sparkles. And so for me, that's how the beads look. The sparkles represent the stars for me, but it goes into something a little deeper than just the looking at the stars, because a lot of our ceremonial songs and prayers have to do with the stars and star people, star beings. And so it really more is of a feeling rather than trying to translate a constellation onto a garment or something. So it's just a way for me to remember those kinds of things from growing up.
The beadwork is so intricate. For me, I look at that and I think the patience that must take to do something.
Yeah. My grandmother did a lot of the beading herself for like fans and gourds and just different, like a pin or a brooch or a hairpiece or medallions that were placed on garments. And so when we would visit her, she would be sitting on the couch and she'd have her little glasses on and she'd be beading. And, you know, I just liked watching her go through the motions of tacking a bead, bringing the needle back up, tacking another bead and bringing the needle up. And so when we went to visit, you were either playing outside or you're inside. If you're inside, then she's weaving or she's beading. And so you're watching either one. One day she said, she gave me a piece of something to work on. And so I started to work on it and just mostly learning about, mostly from watching her. And then, you know, she would give me a little like, okay, well, this is not quite that good. So take it apart and try it again.
What was it that specifically drew you to formal wear?
When I was growing up, whenever we had to go take part in a ceremony of some kind or to go visit people or to go to town to do shopping or something, you know, you would always dress up in your best, kind of similar to like your Sunday best type thing or your evening wear for a gala or something. So it was kind of the way I see it is it's our equivalent of that. And so men and women would dress in like silk velvets or silk satin and wear this jewelry and their hair would be done really nice and proper. And so I think that was what really pushed me toward evening wear, because I felt that that was a connection right there with mainstream society and what my family, our tribe does. And so that's the direction that I took. And, you know, I really liked evening wear because you can go to the extreme with the embellishing and the aesthetics that go into some evening wear as far as embellishing. And then also like just form and structure. It's just a lot of fun to be able to do that with clothing.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you, Stacey. I appreciate it.
Orlando Degay is a fashion designer from Santa Fe, New Mexico. His first solo museum exhibition, Walking in Beauty, Designs by Orlando Degay, is on display at the Avenir Museum of Design and Merchandising through December 14th. Stacey Nick, KUNC.
Orlando Degay will present a series of gallery talks Saturday, November 9th at the Avenir Museum. You can find out more about the event as well as see photos of his designs at kunc.org.
That's our show for today. But before we let you go, we want to tell you a little more about a special show we're doing on Monday for Veterans Day.
I'll be hosting the show with KUNC's military and investigative reporter Michael DeJoanna. And we'll be exploring a few different topics, like the growing civilian-military divide and how the military is contending with climate change. We'll head to the Arctic to investigate how warming temperatures and melting sea ice are threatening some of the technology that's vital to U.S. national security.
Plus, we'll hear about increasing geographic diversity in the military and learn about an unassuming radio station in Fort Collins that may be our key to survival someday.
Be sure to join us Monday evening for that special Veterans Day episode of the show. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer, and our theme music was composed by Colorado musicians Brianna Harris and Johnny Burroughs.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.